This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show with a discussion with John Nichols. He's the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. It's also online, thenation.com, and host of the Next Left podcast. John will be in Fargo Friday and Saturday for some events around the Human Rights Coalition and the Human Rights Film Festival. He joins us by phone today. John, thanks for joining us.
Great honor to be on with you.
Give us your background, if you would. What brought you to The Nation? What was your training?
I have a background that North Dakotans will probably understand reasonably well. I grew up in a very, very small town in rural Wisconsin. My family roots back to Wisconsin almost 200 years ago. They came as Cornish tin miners who ended up mining lead in southwest Wisconsin and then becoming farmers.
Yeah.
Unlike North Dakotans, we tended to be dairy farmers, but but very much a rural culture. And I grew up with the wonderful experience of, you know, small town community and frankly politics. I was always interested in politics as a kid and always interested in journalism. And so I started writing for my small-town weekly paper, which had a circulation of about 900. At the age of 11, I rode my bike down Main Street. I told the guy who ran the publication, a guy named Carl Kruger, who was the editor, publisher, photographer, reporter, typesetter, ad salesman, yeah, janitor, as any classic small-town weekly, that I had read the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. I'd seen Woodward and Bernstein take down a president, and I knew that free press was the underpinning of democracy, and I was reporting for duty. And he told me that if the photos turned out, I'd get $5 for each one, and I'd get $5 for a story. And that night, I covered the school board.
Okay.
Been doing journalism ever since.
So how'd you get to The Nation?
Well, I loved politics. I loved covering politics. And so I worked for a lot of newspapers over the years and then started writing magazine pieces relatively young for a magazine in Wisconsin called The Progressive, which was kind of the great old progressive populist magazine of the upper Midwest. And folks at The Nation started to see some of the pieces I wrote. And about 20 years ago, they reached out and asked if I wanted to start contributing some pieces. And it went well. I ended up covering a lot of politics for The Nation starting around 2000, and I've been doing it ever since. Every presidential campaign over the last 20 years. And then that evolved into writing books. In fact, I kind of, oddly enough, am a beneficiary of one of the great meltdowns of American politics, and that was the Florida recount of 2000.
Oh, counting Chads, yes.
Yes, and terribly designed ballots and everything else, just all the messes of that. I wrote a lot about it, and I was asked by a publisher if I wanted to do a book on it. I did, and that did pretty well, and then I wrote a biography of Dick Cheney that did very well, or did well enough, you know. I mean, being a Midwesterner, you don't brag, you try not to brag. But that just evolved into doing a lot of writing on politics and media, a lot of books, including a history of impeachment, which is now somewhat relevant, and a lot of magazine writing. And I've been doing it now for, it seems like, a very long time.
Well, The Nation is the oldest continuously published weekly magazine in the United States. That is unique in its own right. It's also progressive. You've identified your writing as progressive, so define that for us.
Sure. I mean, it's a charged term, isn't it? Because
yeah,
people have all sorts of different definitions for it. And a lot of folks on the East Coast tend to define it as sort of pretty much the same as liberal. Right? You know, another variation on the term. Those of us in the upper Midwest understand it differently. I think we have a deeper understanding. And it really roots back about 100, 120 years ago to when the states of Wisconsin, Minnesota, and North Dakota were really trying to explore a different kind of politics. These were states that were primarily agricultural, but with some industry. And they were very much oppressed by bankers and railroad magnates and powerful folks who tended to live out on the East Coast someplace, or maybe in Chicago. And movements developed out in this part of the country that said, you know, no, we'd like to have a little more control over what we produce and how it's sold and how we process it. And out of that grew distinct state-based movements. In Wisconsin, the Progressive Party, eventually, and the Progressive Movement is led by Robert M. La Follette, the great senator from Wisconsin. In Minnesota, a similar movement, the Farmer Labor Party, and up in North Dakota, the Nonpartisan League.
Yes.
These were very closely associated political movements. And they had a couple touchstones to them. One, they really believed that people could manage their own affairs better than distant bankers. And so they set up in North Dakota, classically, the state bank, but also grain mills and other processing operations. Similar things happen in Wisconsin and Minnesota. The other thing that was interesting about them is they tended to be very friendly to labor unions. They believed farmers should be organized. They were not always perfect on it, but they tended to come around earlier than a lot of other folks to being supportive of women's rights, of civil rights. And a fundamental touchstone for them was that they tended to be very anti-war. If you were to tie the one sort of thread through the North Dakotans, Minnesotans, and Wisconsinites of that era, they really opposed World War I. They thought it was a terrible idea. And that tended to make them outliers politically. They were often ostracized. And yet, at the state level, in these three states, they developed out a distinctive politics. And I think you can see a line that goes all the way from 100, 120 years ago to the present, where you see political figures today who make arguments that are not so different. And that would be, you know, you'd hear it from an Elizabeth Warren, a Bernie Sanders, even an AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And so I do see that thread, and I write a lot about it.
Is the nation singing to the choir? You know, is the National Review singing to another choir, for example?
That's a terrific question. Well, I came up around Jesse Jackson, and so I always remember his great line that, you know, the choir is actually pretty important, right? The choir needs to have some music. The choir needs to have some ideas. And so, yeah, those who sing to the choir or who perhaps provide a little bit of insight, a little bit of music, have a value. But yeah, look, in the United States, this is the interesting thing. We have many traditions of ideological or point of view journalism, and they are deeply rooted and very intellectual. I think even you could say, you know, fact-based and hopefully fair, but with a point of view that says, you know, look, you tend to be on the right, tend to be on the left. And that's very different than where we're at now with this circumstance where we talk a lot about a siloed media where people only hear the views that that they agree with or only hear from people like them. In the best tradition of The Nation, which is on the left, and the National Review, which is on the right, we produce articles, ideas, statements, which we hope, you know, I always hope people would read The Nation and the National Review, right, and sort it out. I happen to think what we write is right, and often what they write is wrong, but that's a point of view.
Yeah.
And that's where you get a very, very healthy debate. Yesterday I was on CNN International, doing an analysis of the elections with Christiane Omnipour. And I was on with Scott Jennings, who is a longtime Republican political operative who now is teaching, I think, up at Harvard. And we had a wonderful discussion. We had disagreements about some interpretations of things. We, you know, obviously put different ideas forward, But at the end of the conversation, I think we were both complimenting each other, and we were both sampling from what the other person said and saying, you know, I really disagree with him on that, but what he said there is actually true. And so my point is that historically in this country, we have had a discourse rooted in real disagreements, but in a shared set of facts. One of the challenges we have today is that we have a lack of discourse, often rooted in deep disagreements, but not in a shared set of facts. And that's what makes it, I think, complicated and sometimes a little unpleasant.
Well, so we've had the term.
Should we still try to draw it back to reality?
We've had the term alternate facts that's been put out there, actually.
Yeah.
You and I will be talking on stage at the Fargo Theater Friday evening following the showing of the documentary The Brainwashing of My Dad. And that gets to a little bit of what you were just talking about, the nature of the siloed media we have or the echo chambers that people may rather visit as opposed to listening to somebody who disagrees with them. Talk a bit about the media landscape that exists out there that allows people literally to shut out the world.
I think we're in a really nightmarish situation right now, and frankly, a pretty bad one for the country. The roots of the American experiment are in an ideal stated by some of the founders, and that was that if people had access to information and the freedom to discuss it, by and large, they would sort things out. There would definitely be disagreements, but they could get someplace. Where we're at right now is that we've ended a lot of those discussions. We've put ourselves in a situation where people talk to people who agree with them. They get information that they agree with. It's not always reliable. It does reinforce often their worst fears and often their prejudices. And this is exceptionally problematic. And there's a couple reasons why it's happening. One of the most important reasons why it's happening is that we have had a collapse of traditional journalism in the United States. And traditional journalism wasn't perfect. There was plenty to criticize. But when you see massive layoffs of newspaper reporters, literally tens of thousands, we're down an incredible number over the last 20 years. When you see the loss of radio shows, you're doing a great show, but I can tell you a lot of local radio across this country has just disappeared. And when our TV stations become really kind of slurries of weather reports and a lot of sports and very little news, what happens is we lose that local element. And so the discussion kind of airs upward all the way to Washington. And you get these nationalized cable channels and streamed radio and all these programs where you just hear, you know, kind of your side. This is not the way it ought to be. The healthier way is to have a lot of strong media at the local level in a place like Fargo, in a place like North Dakota. And it should be competing. There should be different points of view. But at the end of the day, there ought to be discussion and dialogue. And out of that, I think, does come a healthier discourse. One of the other things, too, is I think our discourse has become so nationalized that we're losing the distinct regional character and culture of how we communicate and how we do politics. You know, North Dakota has one of the richest, most wonderful political traditions in the United States. I could go on about North Dakota for, you know, a year and not be satisfied with the discussion because it's this rich, deep tradition. There has been a left, there has been a right, there have been populist traditions and reactionary traditions, but it's fascinating and it's distinct from the United States. And if you know that tradition, if you're rooted in the discourse of the state, there are going to be points where you can come together. There may be points of deep disagreement, even, you know, dare I say, hate, you know, might even see now and again. But there's also somewhere to some common ground. If you nationalize everything, if all of the discourse is about, you know, Donald Trump or somebody that doesn't like Donald Trump or what's happening in Washington, what happened to your U.S. Senate race last year where it all came down to so much of this Brett Kavanaugh stuff, right?
Yeah.
You lose that local character. And the things that I really fight for is an argument that that as we evolve our media system, and it is changing, we have to break away from the nationalized discussion and bring it back down to where we live. If we don't, it makes it so easy for us to get into camps and to look at somebody who disagrees with us on some national issue and see them as evil or, you know, so distant or so wrong that we can't possibly like them. And that's, to my mind, very unhealthy for a politics or frankly, even for just basic relations.
Well, it seems also that that particular direction that the business has gone has also created this sort of discourse that relies on ad hominem, attacking the person, that relies on diversion. This is my talking point today. I'm not talking about that. So there's a lot of escaping the actual questions and people are starting to reflect that themselves, the way they go on social media and relate to each other in ways they never would have if they were face-to-face.
Well, and you know what? Here's an interesting thing, right? I grew up in a very small town. When I was born, there were 970 people in the town where I was born. We had liberals and conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, and people that were to the left of Democrats and to the right of Republicans. And a lot of folks who didn't really care that much about politics. But we all knew each other. I literally could name the family in every house, I think, as you went down the street. And there was some sort of sense of connectedness there. It didn't mean that we didn't disagree. We could disagree very passionately, and often did. But it did mean that we were still kind of working at it, trying to figure it out. And there was, dare I say, something that's missing today, shame. You know, if somebody said something that was obnoxious or wrongheaded or cruel, the community kind of said, hey, you really went too far there. That wasn't right.
John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation. He's also host of the Next Left podcast. You can find out more at thenation.com. Again, he'll be appearing Friday evening for the North Dakota Human Rights Film Festival at the Fargo Theater following the brainwashing of my dad. That starts around 7 o'clock. It runs till 9:30, the event. And he and I will talk on stage about the media and about his views on those things. He's also the keynote speaker for the North Dakota Human Rights Coalition's 10th Annual Human Rights Summit on Saturday. John, thank you for joining us today.
Great honor to be with you.
Coming up next on Main Street, another profile from the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming, along with our members and other sources, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. November is Native American Heritage Month, and today we have another notable addition to the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor. Charles Murphy, former Standing Rock Tribal Chair, was inducted this year in the category of leadership. In a profile produced by Makoche Studios of Bismarck, we hear from Charles, scholar Mary Louise Defender Wilson, Standing Rock Tribal Council Member Frank Whitebull, former North Dakota Governor Ed Schaefer, and current Standing Rock Tribal Chair Mike Faith.
I'm going to tell you a story. It was in July. It was really hot, 95 degrees at about 10 o'clock in the morning, And three elderly women come into my office, and they were all wearing the same sweater. Man, I didn't say nothing. It was hot, I said, before you ask me a question, I said, I want to ask you a question. All wear the same sweater. I said, why is that? She said, we were taught when we meet our leader that we don't come in a short sleeve dress. I said, thank you. 32 years old, and here they were, 60 to 70 years old, coming to see me, respecting me as their leader. These people didn't have to say that to me, but they did, and they respected that office. When you respect people, they'll respect you back. And I think that was the reason why that I sat so long in that office.
Charlie Murphy was chairman of the Standing Rock Reservation for over 30 years. And I always think that who we are comes from who our ancestors were. They were that kind of people who seemed to have this very deep interest in caring about the people. And I think Charlie, somehow that rubbed off on him.
He was the youngest chairman coming on board, you know, the youngest chairman elected. I believe he was around 30, 32 years old.
Back in 1983, there was probably about 14,000 enrolled members of Standing Rock at the time I was elected. I kind of grew up within our district running their little community called Porcupine. A lot of the elders there in the district of Porcupine kind of grew me to for about 4 years there, saying that I should run for tribal council.
He was a very Ekchewekchasha, a common man. That's what he exemplified in his leadership. He never was said above here or down below, or together.
And I think it came through when he was our chairman. That's the way he ran his office.
One of the things that made me really, really happy, that it may not mean a lot to some people, but it meant a lot to me, though, to bring streets and sidewalks and driveways into our homes.
Charlie had a knack to get people together and understand and put the differences aside.
I don't tell him really what to do and everything, but I will coax him along, you know.
He led us in a direction as a tribe to be known in not only in the states, North and South Dakota, and in Indian country, but at the federal level.
He earned the trust of the people. He earned the trust of his tribal council. He kept getting reelected. So he had some credibility as a leader. So when I was elected governor, we had a chance to sit down and say, okay, how are we going to improve the government-to-government relationships between the Standing Rock Reservation and the state of North Dakota? He took a strong lead, and we developed the first ever compact, government-to-government compact between our two governments.
I don't know exactly how many times I went to Washington, but it had to be over 100 times, you know.
I remember times when we went out there, the senators went out of their way, congressmen went out of their way, went up to Charlie and started shaking his hand, you know. And I was impressed by that. He just made things happen out in D.C. He was a leadership role in the beginnings of the JTAC.
We made sure that we fought for our lands, that when they flooded our lands back in 1958, saying that we'll give you the X number of dollars, and it was actually pennies, was given to our people.
He went there to say, this is what happened to us, and this is what needs to be done.
Our tribe ended up getting $90.6 million for the economic loss of our lands along the Taken area.
He was quiet. He wasn't a firebrand. He didn't pound the table. But he always gave you a complete story and told the truth about everything, good and bad. And when you negotiate from that standpoint, you know, that's when you can accomplish something, and he did.
He is really a caring individual and looked out for everybody. He inspired me a lot, and I appreciate him to this day. Fantastic chairman to Standing Rock.
That audio came to us from Mokoche Studios, which has produced videos for all of the inductees to the Native American Hall of Honor. You can find those videos online at vimeo.com/Mokoche. That's M-A-K-O-C-H-E. Coming up on Main Street, Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota, Sue Balcom for Main Street Eats, and our What's Happening calendar of things to do. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The owners of a wind farm near Valley City want to repower the existing farm by installing larger turbines and bigger blades. But the North Dakota Public Service Commission isn't yet ready to give it the go-ahead. The Ashtabula Wind Energy Center was built by NextEra Energy. Part of the farm was sold to Otter Tail Power. NextEra wants to raise the capacity from its part of the center from the current 148 megawatts to 160.4 megawatts. Commissioner Randy Christman asked that a decision be postponed. He says he has some concerns about potential repowering in the future. He says the company wants to drop any reference to capacity numbers from the proposed commission order.
But to completely eliminate that, and like I say, far out into the future, now there is no more capacity on it, and basically the sky's the limit on these 99 turbine sites, I think is not the best way for us to go, and I think we should keep the capacity limits on it.
But Commissioner Julie Fedorchak says the legislature several sessions ago passed what's known as the footprint law. In that, an energy company that gets a siting permit will be able to do pretty much anything it wants, as long as it is within that siting footprint.
We're seeing this in other facilities like pipelines, et cetera, where they're expanding beyond the capacity that's contemplated in the original filing, using this procedure established by the legislature in law.
Christman responded that the law also says the PSC must make sure there is orderly development of energy facilities, and he worries about congestion on the power grid.
These 99 turbines could go from a megawatt and a half to hard telling how much and cause enormous congestion problems, and that would not be orderly development.
The PSC will hold a work session on the matter. And Grand Forks is looking to land a new drone manufacturing facility. The city council meeting as the Jobs Development Authority has agreed to a $400,000 loan to Mobile Recon Systems. The Kentucky-based company will also receive $400,000 from the North Dakota Development Fund and utilize a $400,000 private bank loan to bring the corporate headquarters to Grand Forks. Grand Forks EDC's Brandon Bombach says it's a $1.2 million investment.
Designs and manufactures unmanned aerial vehicles that boasts an ability to lift more than 200 pounds, which is a tremendous amount for the market today. They've developed four different models of UAVs with a variation of capacity and application. Now, beyond prototyping and sales have begun to come in, they're seeking the right place to establish a manufacturing facility.
Company CEO Tom Nichols says there are all kinds of uses for drones, but they focused on lift functionality.
So that includes things like supply chain logistics, basically replacing transport from helicopters and jeeps and so on, both military and commercial. Search and rescue, the ability to get in where helicopters, for instance, can't go to deliver supplies and rescue people. Utility line inspection, other kinds of aerial inspections.
The company expects to create 13 jobs in the Grand Forks area. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. When Chuck Lura goes outdoors, he, of course, takes his naturalist eyes and ears along. And sometimes he comes across something surprising. That's the subject of today's Natural North Dakota essay.
I suspect that the vast majority of North Dakotans have heard coyotes vocalize. They are commonly heard across the state, howling, yipping, yapping, and yodeling. But I don't think many of us have heard a fox vocalize. I hadn't until recently, or perhaps I just didn't know what I had heard. At any rate, I was out for a walk around dusk one evening a couple weeks ago, and noticed a red fox intently hunting in a grassy area. When it finally saw me, immediately ran into a stand of nearby aspen. I continued my walk, and a few minutes later heard what I can best describe as a bark-like scream, or a scream-like bark. I heard it a couple times, and it came from the direction of the aspen trees where I had last seen the fox. Upon my return home, the fox was back again, feeding in the grassy area. It promptly and quietly ran away upon seeing me again. I couldn't help but think that the call I heard came from that fox, so I had to do some checking. I was surprised to learn that the red fox has a wide range of vocalizations. They're known to produce over 20 different kinds of vocalizations. Their calls have been variously described as barks, shrieks, screams, whimpers, whines, chucklings, and others. And as you might expect, each individual can be identified by their vocalizations. At least one source of information noted that most of the calls may be divided into two basic categories, what are called contact calls or interaction calls. Contact calls are probably the most commonly heard type of call that's used when they approach one another. They consist of a series of 3 to 5 barks. There are also interaction calls, which consist of a variety of vocalizations, including shrieks, whines, rattling sounds, and others. What I apparently heard has been described as a bark when it's used when danger is detected. And I found some recordings of these calls on the internet. Many, however, were a little different in pitch, etc. I did, however, find that a few were very similar to what I heard. So if you're interested in what the danger call of a red fox sounds like, I put a link to a recording of it along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access it at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Bear Walls, the North Dakota Museum of Art's annual Autumn Art Auction, will be held on November 16th, beginning at 6:30 with wine, hors d'oeuvres, and live music, followed by a live auction of 50 works of art by the region's leading artists at 8 p.m. Tickets available by calling the museum at 701-777-4195. Artworks can be viewed at the museum or online at ndmoa.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and Ashley Thornburg joins me in our Fargo studio because we're going to talk to Sue Balcom about, well, Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So last week was Halloween, and there were many a jack-o'-lantern dotting the front steps, and now we have some leftover pumpkin that
leftover
maybe we
pumpkin.
Should do something with.
Right. Like maybe throw them out so the deer can eat them, and then that
That's
way it'll
thing.
Detract them from your garden where your good pumpkins are growing. And good squash, which is another fall in-season vegetable or fruit, depending on who you are. Again, there's that basic, you know, is it a pumpkin a vegetable or is a pumpkin a fruit? Scientifically, it has seeds in it, so that makes it a fruit. But nutritionally, they are better for you as a vegetable. And so we love to eat pumpkins this time of year. And squash, too, which they're both interchangeable, as you know. If you buy a can of pumpkin in the store, you're probably getting a Blue Hubbard squash
pretty much.
The mix.
Well, jack-o'-lanterns, often you want that big pumpkin so that there's lots of room for carving. Are the big ones still good for eating? You know, sometimes a squash gets – or sometimes a zucchini gets so big – you don't want to.
Right, because
know, eat
then they
it.
Become mostly seeds. But I know that especially, well, like Blue Hubbard squashes, they grow to be about the size of a black lab sometimes in your garden. And pumpkins, of course, everybody wants to grow the biggest one.
Yeah, but there are contests.
Yes,
for that.
They are. And I wish I could remember what the largest pumpkin was.
Well, I was in Stillwater, Minnesota once for a pumpkin festival a long time ago, and it was over 1,000 pounds.
Holy
what?
Cow. How yeah. do you move them around?
Well, they had trucks and you know, cranes, literally.
How much is a car?
Like, I don't know.
About 3,000 pounds.
Oh, yeah. My God.
So Cinderella wasn't too far off when they used a pumpkin for her carriage,
seriously.
Right? So,
yeah.
But how would you, like, you'd need a pickaxe to bust through that skin on a 1,000-pound pumpkin, wouldn't you? And
would
that would
so.
Make a lot of pie. So those pumpkins, in addition to probably not being very good because they do have candle wax in them and soot and all that stuff from Halloween, you want to go for maybe a squash and or a sugar pumpkin, a pie pumpkin, if you're going to actually process them. And it's quite easy, of course, to do that. You need to, like a jack-o'-lantern, scoop out its brains. And you can save the seeds or not. That's totally up to you.
The
but
pepitas?
Pumpkin seeds, yes, they are very good for you.
Yes, they are. They're tasty.
And tasty, yep. And they're simply roasted. You can soak them in salt water before you roast them so they have a little bit of salt on them or just the way they are. And then garnish your pumpkin soup with them, of course.
What is the difference between a pepita and a pumpkin seed?
I don't think anything. I think
okay.
that's just
I see them sold separately.
That really?
Yeah.
Maybe
and
one
the
is
closest
hauled
thing
and
I
not.
Can figure out is that, yeah, one's been shelled and one hasn't. But I'm not entirely sure.
Some of us eat the hard shell on the outside, and then some of us don't in our house.
Well, it's like the sunflower seed deal, you know.
Right.
Some of us just go ahead and grind that fiber into us.
Right, because it can't be all that bad, get it? Pumpkins
are
orange.
Spitting is gross.
Well, no, it's not, is it? Jeez, you got to sit outside and spit sun seeds at softball games. Yeah.
Can't do it.
You know what drives me crazy, on a side note here, is when people get offended because you're spitting sun seeds on the ground. And I'm like, are you kidding me? They're biodegradable. Right. A lot better than drinking all that plastic bottle you've got.
Right. No.
Well, it's another orange.
Orange vegetable. So, it's an orange vegetable,
so
not
like,
a fruit.
Like carrots, it's got that carotene in it?
Right, and they are good for your eyes, rich in vitamin A and high in antioxidants. They are also low in calories. Like pumpkin is very low in calories. Squash is very low in calories. It's just how we eat it that changes that.
Yeah, usually butter and sugar.
Yeah, no kidding. And so when we make squash or pumpkin as a side dish at our house, and it is interchangeable. You can eat pumpkins just like you do squash, you know, cut them up, peel them, roast them, and then one half of the pan gets brown sugar and maple syrup for my husband, and the other half gets either onion and salt and pepper or just butter and salt and pepper, tons of butter and salt.
So savory or sweet, huh?
Correct, and we have to make both because JC doesn't like it so much when it's just served as a savory vegetable. And then, of course, there's all the wonderful things you can make, like pumpkin pie and blagenda and pumpkin butter.
What's
and pumpkin
blagenda?
Cheesecake. You've never had a blagenda?
Never heard of it.
Oh, my gosh, you guys, seriously? Oh, I hope I can get around to making some of those. They're actually like a hand pie that the Germans used to make all the time where I came from. You can make them savory with onion, you know, so you actually, they'd scrape the pumpkin with a large spoon. So it'd be like grated pumpkin mixed with onion, salt, and pepper. And then you bake it in a pastry shell, kind of like a pie crust or a soft, sweet dough. And they would eat them as part of their main meal with bean soup. Usually they were paired with a bean soup in the fall.
So this is like a samosa or an empanada or?
Sort of, yes, but the German-Russian kind. So my mom...
It's a hand pie.
My mom made them with spices, the pumpkin spices and sugar. And, oh, my gosh, oh, they were just like having your own pumpkin pie with lots and lots of pie crust because you needed lots of crust to hold that nice soft filling in place. And everybody makes them this time of year if you're of that ethnic origin because there are lots and lots of pumpkins available out there. And then, of course, pumpkin butter. If you have tons of pumpkin, you can peel them and put them in your crock pot with a little bit of water and just cook that down, sweeten it to taste. You can can it. You can just put it in the refrigerator and slather it on your toast in the mornings. And so it's, if you don't put so much sugar in, it can't be so bad for you, can it?
So you're just cooking the pulp down? Is that what you're doing?
Yep, correct. Just like you would with an apple butter. You're reducing it, and by doing that, you're actually increasing its flavor exponentially. It's really a good way, too, that you can put a lot of pumpkin in a little space.
That's a great idea.
Yep, and if you don't want to do that, you absolutely can cook it down to a certain stage, put it in plastic bags, freezer bags or freezer containers, and you can just freeze it like it is. The difference is when you bring it out of the freezer, you should drain a little bit of the water off because it does get a little bit watery. But they do not recommend canning or pressure canning pumpkin like pumpkin chunks and things like that because it's too thick to process carefully at home.
Let's talk about the pumpkin as a cooking container.
Yes, that's right. Pumpkins are so versatile. So my friend Sarah, I'm working on a cookbook at our church for our 40th anniversary, and one of the recipes that was submitted from Sarah Coleman in Bismarck was beef stew in a pumpkin. And what they do is they kind of have a celebratory pumpkin festival at their house every year because they have like four kids, I think. And so what she does is she prepares a beef stew that she actually cuts the top off a pumpkin, making sure that you can fit that pumpkin in your oven. So, like, yeah. Don't get a 1,000-pound pumpkin and think you're going to stuff it in your oven. So you want to put your rack down low, and you have a baking sheet underneath it because, of course, it'll weep a little bit. Scrape out the inside, save the seeds, fill that up with your beef stew meat, your onions, your carrots, your broth and soy sauce, garlic, onions, salt and pepper, all that kind of good stuff. And then prepare your beef stew, put it in your pumpkin, and bake it for about an hour with its lid on. You got to put the lid back on. And then very carefully, because your pumpkin will have gotten soft by then, and don't check that by sticking a fork in it, okay? Because you're going to lose a little bit of the insides, and you don't want to do that. Carefully remove that from the oven. And then when you serve your beef stew, you want to scrape out a little bit of that pumpkin on the side and maybe even add some mashed potatoes to the mix.
Wow.
Oh, that sounds good.
Oh, my gosh. And I'm so hungry right now. And this room, I have to tell you, real quickly, there's one other thing my mom used to do with pumpkin in the fall. She would make stumpfe, and I think that's the right German word. And so you've got potatoes and pumpkin that you boil together with allspice and bay leaf and a little bit of onion and salt and pepper. And then you create a roux with flour and lard, and you make that nice and brown. And then you mash your potatoes and add that browned flour in there. Remove your spices, of course. And that's what we had that as a side dish all the time. Sometimes it's potatoes with cabbage, but a lot of times it was potatoes with pumpkin. And we just called them pumpkin potatoes.
And so in this case, are you wanting to just always make sure you're using a savory pumpkin, or what would happen if you used a sugar pumpkin for this?
Sugar pumpkins are only called sugar pumpkins because they have a richer flavor. They're not necessarily sweeter, but they're less watery, and they're denser flesh. And so they just work better for pies. So you can add, whatever sweeteners you want to them in whatever doses you would like.
Well, bon appetit. That's beef stew and a pumpkin. Sounds pretty good to me.
Awesome.
We check in with Sue Belcom every week here on Main Street.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What's happening is next.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with the director of North Dakota's Behavioral Health Division, Pam Sagnus, about some new initiatives going on, and we'll have a story on a Braddock, North Dakota printing press. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
What's going on? That's the question. It's that time of week to look at the calendar with Ashley Thornburg and see what's happening.
And, of course, November 11th is a date that we hold to honor the brave veterans who have fought for this country. There are a number of commemoration ceremonies across the state that you can go and check out. So make sure that you take a moment on Monday and possibly even beyond Monday to say thanks to the women and men who have fought hard for this country.
Well, I'm going to start with the sounds of the gridiron. That's Sunday at the Fargo Dome. This is quite a treat for people. It's free and open to the public. The NDSU Gold Star Marching Band is in performance at the Fargo Dome. You know, they're usually there for the games, the home games. But this is going to run from 2 to 4 in the afternoon on Sunday. The NDSU Gold Star Marching Band in performance at the Fargo Dome.
There's going to be a presentation on the history of marriage and weddings coming up here on the 10th in Rugby at the high school auditorium. Spoiler alert, a lot of weddings are just about consolidating money and power and not so much about love that they've hopefully evolved into by now. Some have evolved into that. One of my favorite marriage traditions is why we carry flowers is because people stunk. And you needed something better to smell. So come check out all the things that we do in the name of love or consolidating power. in rugby on the 10th at the high school auditorium as Dr. Stephanie Kuntz from Oregon speaking about the history of marriage. This talk, I should mention, is in conjunction with an exhibit at the Prairie Village Museum that features wedding dresses from 1880 to 1930. Gets going at 2 p.m.
The Ballad of Gopher Gap by the No Name Players in Lisbon. It runs from November 7th through the 10th at the Lisbon Opera House. It's a pioneer drama. Thursday through Saturday, the performances are at 7:30. Sunday, there's a matinee at 2 p.m. It's a $9 ticket to see the Ballad of Gopher Gap by the No Name Players in Lisbon.
Well, pioneer, something of a theme here. The Film Society in Dickinson is showing Farmsteaders November 9th at the Dickinson Area Public Library, and you get an intimate portrait of farmsteaders as they move from a quaint dairy farm to large-scale farming. You follow Nick Nolan and his family. This is on Saturday at 2 p.m. at the Dickinson Area Public Library, and it's free.
Well, the Badlands Art Association 49th Annual Art Show is in Dickinson, November 8th through the 10th. It features art from all ages. There'll be live music Friday night from 6 to 9. Then Saturday, there'll be a show will be open from 10 to 4 in the afternoon, and from Sunday from noon to 4 p.m. It's free to see the Badlands Art Association's 49th Annual Art Show in Dickinson.
Here's a very important one: climate change and food production and what could happen to our food systems in light of climate change. This is going to be happening in Valley City on the 7th, so that is tonight, at Valley City State University, the Science Center Auditorium. Dr. Phyllis Johnson is giving a presentation on how climate change is impacting agriculture and food production. Again, that's tonight in Valley City, a presentation at 7 p.m. on climate change and its impacts on large-scale production agriculture.
The Moon and Beyond is pretty much a big deal going on in the Fargo-Moorhead area from Friday through Monday. And it's several opportunities to look through telescopes and to find out about the heavens above us. And it's a collaboration of a number of nonprofit groups in town here. They're also talking about a possible new science museum. That's a project that's in the works. But this Moon and Beyond event, which is taking place in Fargo-Moorhead, and there's also an event in other places around the state, including in Dickinson, commemorates the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing, which, of course, happened in 1969. So you can Google the Moon and Beyond. You can Google the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing, and you'll find out more information about ways it's being observed.
My pick of the week is that November is Native American Heritage Month, and there is a number of events across the state, from lessons in history to contemporary art and music. And I want to highlight a couple here. One in Williston on the 10th at the Williston Community Library, as there are special guests from the Northern Plains Oyate people who will be speaking about Native American cultural education. And there will be storytelling and dream catcher craft making. There will be dances and drumming, storytelling. This event is happening on Sunday from 1 to 5 p.m. in Williston at the community library. And I'm also very interested in this one on the 9th at the Fargo Public Library, a presentation on Donna Lunday, by Donna Lunday, on the importance of the jingle dress and the significance that it holds in sacred ceremonies. And there's even going to be some Wojapi pudding. It's a fabulous pudding. Sean Sherman has a great recipe for it. You could check this out Saturday at 10 a.m. at the Fargo Library.
Well, I'm picking the Human Rights Film Festival and the Human Rights Summit. Both are taking place in Fargo this weekend, but the film festival has been around the state a bit. It's been in Bismarck and Minot. It'll be in Grand Forks. The festival show on Friday evening will feature the documentary The Brainwashing of My Dad, which chronicles the producer's father going through an experience by listening to just one channel of news and We'll talk about it on stage, I will, with John Nichols. He's a pioneering political blogger and a correspondent for The Nation magazine. Tonight on stage at the Fargo Theater, where all this is taking place, Jessica Thomason of Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota will be joined on stage by Reverend Grace Murray and Pastor Joe Larson, and talking about what the majority population should do to accommodate new populations of minorities and new Americans. So that's going on. And then on Saturday, there will also be the North Dakota Human Rights Coalition's annual meeting and Arc of Justice Awards. It's all day Saturday. You can find out more by going to Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota's website and discover information about that as well. That's what's happening.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 7th. If you were to drive about 8 miles north-northeast of Hazen, you would find two cemeteries and an old flour mill. If you got out and walked around, you might be lucky enough to chance upon an old basement. These are the remnants of Krem, short for Crimea, a name given to it from the many German-Russian immigrants that settled there around the early 1900s. Although it is abandoned now, Krem was once a strong contender for the Mercer County seat against Stanton, nearly taking it in 1906. Krem had been growing since 1902 when Martin Netzer built the first general store. Soon after, in 1903, William Richter opened another general store. The two businesses began viciously competing, which helped Krem become a central hotspot for trade in the county. This growth is what made Krem a popular contender for county seat when the courthouse in Stanton burned down in December of 1905. Krem had widespread support. The Bismarck Tribune said, "It is likely that the county seat of Mercer County will be moved to Krem at the coming election." Krem is situated in the center of one of the richest sections of the state, a gently undulating country settled for 20 years with a happy, prosperous people. And on this date in 1906, the paper wrote, "Mercer County was having a fight, as the location of the present county seat is an outrage. The courthouse should be moved to Krem, or some other point where someone can find out what is going on once in a while." 2 days later, they reported that Krem won by a 2/3 majority. However, the county auditor, Henry Sagehorn, wrote in the Manhaven Journal that a total of 372 votes were cast, of which 236 were in favor of moving and 136 were against it. As this was not a 2/3 majority, the site remained at Stanton. So even though the yeas beat the nays by 100 and Krem had shipped vaults for county offices, Stanton remains the county seat to this day, and Krem is just remnants. The death knell for Krem came in 1914 when the railroad bypassed the town. Perhaps the tracks would have come had it been the county seat. It's interesting to ponder what might have been had the town got just a few more votes. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Friday on Main Street, philosopher Jack Russell Weinstein previews this Sunday's Why radio show. It's on the topic, does accepting the theory of evolution mean there is no meaning of life? November is Native American Heritage Month, and poetry from Studio 47 host Patrick Hicks will profile Virginia Driving Hawks Navy. News director Dave Thompson will talk about the stories making headlines, and Madeline will review The Lighthouse. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.